like scary movies?
Uh-huh. I'm getting ready to watch a video.
You making popcorn?
Uh-huh.
What's your favorite?
I don't know.
You have to have a favorite. Talk to me. Talk to me.
Hi, everybody. I'm George, and welcome to the Best Little Horror House in Philly, the show where we talk about the best horror movie ever made, according to our guest, at least. And today's guest has been making me laugh since the college humor days. You've seen him on shows like 101 Places to Party Before You Die, and you've heard him on podcasts like High and Mighty or Action Boys. John Gabris is in the house. Welcome, dude.
Hey, thanks for having me, George. Stoked to be here. Stoked to talk about what I think is maybe, you know, throw the word best around for horror movies. So this is the best at something very specific, but
that's all it takes, man. All it has to be is that one niche of for best. But before we get into today's pick, why don't you tell us a little bit about your history with horror? If it's something that you're normally reaching for, if it's more a once in a while kind of thing, where it started for you.
I'm a movie person through and through. So horror being a very expansive genre, I'm a big fan. I watch a lot of horror. I wouldn't call myself like a Fangoria guy. You know, I'm not like, right. I'm not an expert. I'm more of into action movies and, you know, 70s stuff, but horror movies rule and I really enjoy them and I like to be scared and I try to get myself to be scared of movies and I love spooky movie season is something we talk about in our house all the time and that's not allowed to start till after Labor Day.
Right.
I mean, we'll watch horror movies year round, but once Labor Day ends through
it's
Labor
very specific.
Yeah. It's like Labor Day through Thanksgiving. My wife and I are constantly watching horror movies, burning through whatever stuff we haven't seen or rewatching favorites and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's even more of a horror head than me. She like loves that. She loves Halloween and spooky stuff and goth shit. So that kind of helps me get my way in.
Hell yeah. And also, I mean, I love that a lot of action movies do tend to toe the line a little bit, especially more modern stuff. You get like The Raid, you get stuff like coming out of Korea. There's a lot of fun like genre blending stuff we talked about. I Saw the Devil on here was really, you know, that's a fucking crazy ass movie.
Oh, I have not seen that. I just am writing it down as we speak now.
Oh, man. Well, definitely recommend it. Hey, best horror movie ever made, I've heard.
Oh, okay. From a previous guest.
That's right. But the movie we're talking about today is Cat's Eye from 1985. One question that I always like to ask comedians is that this movie has a pretty successful tongue-in-cheek tone to me. It threads kind of a difficult needle. Do you tend to like horror comedies, or does it feel like work a lot of the time and you're like, oh, I'm doing mental punch-up?
It doesn't feel like work, but I do prefer pure horror. There are a lot of horror comedies that I have enjoyed over the years, and I like a horror that happens to have a couple of funny moments because,
right.
I mean, I'm sure I'm not the first person to say this, but horror and comedy are even closer together than horror and action in that it's like,
right.
You need to elicit a response. It's one of the few like binaries, did you laugh or were you scared? And that could be like a meter of success for a film. So like, it's that element of like, you need to surprise your audience, you need to lull them into certain believing one thing and then hit them with something that either surprises them comedically or Reagan's head turns around and you get fucking scared shitless. Yeah,
definitely. And I think to your point, when a movie is definitely a horror movie, but people are still like, funny, like that just makes it feel more real. It makes it feel more lived in because people are funny, like people tell jokes to each other,
right?
So
and then like with the old horror movies, you'll find some stuff that'll make you laugh just like contextually or acting style or like director's choice wise, you know.
Yeah.
But also it's like another tension breaker, right? You're like, oh, we laughed at this character and oh no, now they're headed, you know, like, and that shit just works so well.
Yeah, absolutely. Ride that roller coaster for sure.
Yeah.
Director Lewis Teague talked about the difficulty of an anthology movie versus a single narrative. Not saying it's harder or worse per se, but that one specific hurdle and why they're traditionally unsuccessful is because audiences are asked to do more. They have to get to know more people, keep track of their relationships, have three beginnings, three middles, three ends. They get less invested in the lives of the characters, so in his opinion, it's harder to build that tension. Are you generally an anthologies guy, or do you tend to prefer that one narrative?
I prefer one narrative. I'm not really I've enjoyed some anthology movies. The VHS movies come to mind. Cat's Eye. Like, I enjoy them. But again, like, I want to, like, live in a film, you know? Like, I want to, like, sit in it for 90 or, you know, nowadays 240 minutes or whatever. But I want to be able to sit in the movie for a while. And funny about Cat's Eye being an anthology, we'll get into it more, but this movie fucked me up so much when I was a kid, and I didn't even know it was an anthology because I only remembered the triggering part, you know? And then when I rewatched it like 10 years ago, because I was like, this is the movie that, or, you know, 15 years ago, I was like, this is the movie that fucked me up so bad. And then I put it on, and I'm like, Quitters, Inc. You know, like, I was like, what the fuck?
It's a completely different fucking movie.
Yeah. And then I'm like, oh, there's a cat. I remember the cat. And then I was like, oh, shit. Okay, cool. And on this rewatch, the one I did for this record, I got even more enjoyment out of the other stories in the anthology than the third one, the Drew Barrymore one, which is the one that, you know, affected me the most as a child. I think it gave me, and well, whenever we want to get into it, I can get into it, but I think it gave me like a chronic condition. Like it gave me like a medical condition that I deal with for the rest of my life.
Honestly, unsurprising, because this thing was fucking me up, and I'm a grown-ass man. Yeah, so.
Right. That's glad to hear. Even if you're lying, I appreciate
it. What I like about anthologies is when they're an adaptation of short stories like this one, I feel like it works a lot better than adapting short stories into a full-length narrative, because you don't really have to expand on them too much, so they kind of retain the flavor of what made them work in the first place. And so for this, you know, you have Stephen King writing it as well, so he obviously can retain his tone as he puts it onto the screenplay. I think that that is just a real benefit to where anthologies work well for me.
Right, yeah, and it makes sense. If you're going to adapt a short story, it should be a short movie. I mean, unless it's like such a rich short story that left so much on the table, then which then you could go like, all right, well, we can make this into something for sure. You know?
Definitely. So the movie's impetus is Dino De Laurentiis, famed producer, one of the best.
Hero. Yeah. I mean, Conan is one of my favorite movies of all time, so I owe it to him.
He's amazing. He truly, I mean, all of his work with David Lynch as well. I'm a huge David fan.
Oh, so fuck yeah.
He worked with him a ton. And he's convinced that Drew Barrymore is going to be a huge star. And he wants a movie just for her. He'd already worked with both Drew and Stephen King in the adaptation of Firestarter. So in exchange for the sweet, sweet promise of Maximum Overdrive, he solicits King to write something specifically for Drew.
Well, then we have to thank if this movie helped us get Maximum Overdrive, then it's worth it for me. Hopefully this movie wasn't a part of like Drew Barrymore's brutal fucking childhood. I have a feeling it may have been, since we're talking about several different legendary cokeheads involved in one movie. But that's so awesome. That's a great Stephen King's like, look, let me just direct the most batshit thing in the world. Let me almost kill Yardley Smith or whatever, and we'll make a fucking and I'll write the screenplay of two of my stories, and I believe the troll one is not a short story.
Right. Original for this.
Yeah, and that's so fucking cool. Like he pulled that off. And it's so, the thing I also like about these three anthologies, while I just am riffing here, they really are tight little guys, you know, tight little stories where you're like, oh, I felt like I got a resolved ending. I felt like I was with everyone. And then there's not much to them and I mean that as a compliment. Does that make sense?
Right.
It's just kind of like simple and pure in a way that fucking cooks. Like Stephen King's stories themselves, I haven't read a lot of his like stuff in the last decade or so, but I grew up reading a shit ton of it. Rather simple, and not in and again, not in a derogatory way. I was reading The Stand when I was 12. Now, was I like a kind of smart, weird kid? Yes, but at the same time, his reading is very, very approachable. Like his writing is very, very approachable.
Absolutely, and I think that that's exactly what Lewis Teague was trying to tap into. He talked about what makes him great is the way that we all deal with fear every day, but we come up with all these euphemisms like stress and anxiety, and the ability to tap into that is what makes him great. Quote, ever since humans developed the ability to think abstractly and ask the question, what if, we've imagined monsters that don't exist and been feeling fear in our daily lives. It might be fear of being able to pay the rent, or losing your job, or rejection from your girlfriend. All of these are imaginary monsters based on our ability to ask the what if question. And that's why Stephen King has been so successful. He's able to take the everyday monsters that everyone imagines and illustrate those in his stories. People need to have these fears purged. We've gone through the fear experience and come out the other side because it didn't happen, to us at least. So there's a catharsis where inside they know they're not in any real danger, which lets them go out into the world and face these imaginary monsters with a little more peace of mind.
Fuck. Yeah. Correct. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, King's stories that have been adapted into movies are all over the place in like the level of horror involved, and like I'm not like a horror purist and I don't even maybe fully understand all the subcategories or whatever, but
it's
like
all fake.
Pet Cemetery and Tommyknockers, Langoliers, The Stand, The Shining, and then like Misery. And Misery is so fucking good, and I don't know, there's something like really, I know I'm so tired of IP and reboots and all that shit now, but there's something very rich about a bunch of different directors and actors and ensembles and crew and all that shit directing different stories from the same person.
Yeah.
Because it's really fun to see what John Carpenter does with Christine, or, you know, what each one of these directors does with Kubrick does with The Shining, which is pretty much throw out all of Stephen King's writings to the point where he's angry.
Right.
But I love all that. And so Lewis Teague, he did another one of
Cujo.
He did Cujo. Right. And so this is kind of like seeing one director direct three different stories in one movie. So like that appeal that I like, all of a sudden we got it all in one film.
Hell yeah. So yeah, the book that these two short stories come from is Night Shift. That's Quitter's Ink and The Ledge. He does do this original third story around Drew that plays to her strengths. She is featured in every segment in some capacity, though.
Yeah, this is the first time I picked that up. I'm like, is that Drew Barrymore in the photo? Like, how is she related to them or whatever? Like, James Woods is like her uncle or some shit like that, maybe?
There was a cut prologue that I'll get to that.
Oh, hell
really,
yeah.
Kind of like classic Dino. He said, they don't fucking need to know.
And that pissed Teague off, right? Because that was supposed to like lay out some groundwork of like
exactly,
the interconnected universe of it all. Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. But it's tied together with this cat that travels through the stories. They made slight changes to accommodate that, like changing the demonstration of the electrified room in Quitter's Ink from a rabbit to this guy.
Right.
One thing I found really interesting in the commentary was Lewis discussing how people have a much tougher time suspending disbelief when it comes to animals in movies. There's a handler there, obviously, and they were very careful not to hurt them, but people don't believe it in a way that they understand when someone gets shot, it's a special effect. The example was the electrified room itself, where an air pressure hose underneath would, like, startle the cat, and he was like, realism is your enemy in this, because people will turn on you if they think an animal is really being hurt.
Yeah, that's funny. I mean, I guess part of the appeal is that you know the animal hasn't given his consent to be an actor in the film, right? Like, I mean, it's incapable of that, but that's part of what gets in your head of like, this dog didn't want to be in the movie, you know, like, why? It doesn't know, it wants to run free, it doesn't even want to be in a fucking house, because then you're like, watch like a movie where like 12 like sorority girls get their fucking throat slit and you're like, cool. And then you watch a movie where a cat gets fake electrocuted and you're like, you fucking monsters. But it really makes you hate Quitter's Ink. It's a real shortcut, you know, like Blake Snyder wrote the book called Save the Cat, you know, like on the a hero saves the cat and a villain kicks it. And
that's right. So Teague came on while Steven was working to adapt it to screenplay form. He had done Fighting Back for Dino already. He was a big King fan himself and had already directed Cujo. So he was kind of perfect to handle this project. They didn't have any contact on Cujo, but for this movie, worked on the revisions to the screenplay together, and then had King on set a lot to help him prep for directing Maximum Overdrive. He said that King was the most unpretentious person ever, considering his stature, which was nice to hear.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I've heard a lot of positives and a lot of negatives about Stephen King, but one thing I've never heard was that he was pretentious. He's he's sort of like, if you can be a millionaire, prolific, blue-collar author, because he's sort of just like, he's like a grinder, right? He just fucking sits down and jams his bullshit out. Like,
that's absolutely right.
That's so cool.
He also talked about being pals with Dino, who would entertain on Saturdays and, quote, lecture on pasta, which, way to be a fucking stereotype, Dino.
I know, sorry. Hey, Dino, do one of your rigatoni lectures. All right, coming right up. I mean, just hearing that lets you know how much coke was at this weekend event, right? Like, Stephen King, famously, he's talked about it, alcoholic and cokehead, no more. But and movie making in the 70s and 80s was an environment. And then you hear stories like, yeah, Dean, we would all go hang out on a set after working together all these days. Then we'd all go hang out on the weekend and someone would give a fucking TED talk about pasta. It's like, yeah, I think I know what's driving their energy here.
Yeah, that's right. A little something in the sauce.
Marinarawana.
Lewis got his start with Roger Corman as an editor, then second unit director, before eventually directing for him with Lady in Red. And he worked with a lot of hot directors there as an editor at New World, including Jonathan Demme's first film, a Ron Howard movie. James Cameron was there as an art director. He joked in the commentary, if I'd known these guys were going to be so famous, I'd have been nicer to them.
You like to hear that. I appreciate when someone's like brutally honest about their past. I'm like, yeah, well, I dropped the ball here for sure.
Also, Lewis Teague did Alligator. Has no connection to this besides him doing it. Great movie. Robert Forster. Amazing.
Oh, man. I haven't seen that movie in forever. That's a rewatch coming up ASAP for sure.
Oh, it's so good. So the movie was the first movie to be shot at Dino's new studio there. Even the streets of New York were either more urban areas of town or built on the soundstage. It is funny to when they're like, oh yeah, the cat arrived in New York, and they get you off the street as quick as possible to be like, don't look at it.
And the cat ran right inside.
Yeah. Other notable crew members are Jack Cardiff killing it on lighting, Alan Silvestri doing the score.
Yeah. Silvestri surprised me. I was like, talk about blue collar. There's a man who's like probably got a credit on at least one of every single genre of film. Like,
absolutely.
I mean, he's, of course, he works a fucking ton, but he's one of those guys too that he doesn't necessarily have a very specific style. He's just pretty talented. And like, I did enjoy the score, especially in the second story, The Ledge or whatever that one was called. And I was like, oh, who did this? And when I looked it up, I was like, okay, very much a surprise.
Yeah, it was pretty early in his career. He talked about wanting to experiment with new electronic equipment, which was part of how they afforded him, was by just being like, sure, man, go off, do whatever the fuck you want.
Yeah, we can put your name in the credits, right? He's like, yep. He's like, all right, great, I'll go fucking nuts over there, don't worry.
Yeah, and you also have Carlo Rambaldi as the creature supervisor for the troll in the third segment. Carlo also did E.T., famously, so another E.T. connection.
Whoa.
Yeah. So this is the state of the art. This is the newest and best E.T.
I did really enjoy the troll, especially in the wide shots of the miniatures, like when they're like running around underneath a table, and you're like,
so fun.
I'm like, did they build a giant room that looked like little stuff and have a man in a suit running around? I know. And I'm like, that's the shit I fucking love, man. Yeah. Oh.
It's so funny. First of all, yes, the design is just great to start with. But there's also like an amazing photo of him hanging with the suited actor next to the oversized hole in the wall.
Oh, cool.
I was like showing this photo to people, and a friend of mine who loved the troll was shattered. She had no idea he wasn't some kind of like tiny automaton or something. She was like, you can't trust anybody. But the troll was about 4 feet tall, so all the furniture was about 20 to 30 times larger, which, like, that's fucking huge, man.
Whoa, and interesting actor. Four foot, like a little person actor, too. That's such a cool layer, because if you're building, I guess that's easier than building, you know, 20 times a 6 foot actor, but still.
Yeah, exactly.
That's another surprise. I like that.
Yeah, it is cool. He also mentioned that it was very impressive to have this set, but a bit of a pain to shoot, because every time you wanted to move a chair, you can't just go, hey, get a PA to move that chair. You have to go, okay, get the forklift.
So cool.
The stars of each segment are James Woods and Alan King, Bob Hayes and Kenneth McMillan, then Drew Barrymore, like I said, is in each segment, partially because it was billed as a movie starring her, that she's mostly featured in the third movie. Teague was very admiring of her. He talked about this being sort of a transitional period for her, where she's no longer the five-year-old in E.T. who's not acting, but reacting and just being true to what's going on. Here she's actually learning to quote-unquote act. So, you know, kind of an interesting point in her career.
She sells me in the fucking troll. I'm like, I'm on board. I'm scared when she's scared. I'm pro the general when she's pro the general. I'm here for it.
Absolutely. They had a $10 million budget to start. Then 3 days before shooting, Dino comes in and says, quote, you got to cut a $1 million from your budget. That's what Lewis Teague said. That meant cutting days. So The Falling with the Sign was shot in about 25% of the time they wanted.
Oh,
still
man.
Still looks pretty good.
Yeah, it looks pretty awesome.
Considered.
Yeah.
And the movie did okay based on King's name. It grossed $13 million domestically, but really where it sang was in the video market. It did really well. It also played a lot on TV. Teague suspects that it's easier to deal with the anthology series challenges at home because you don't have to deal with it in one sitting, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's like watching three episodes of a TV show. Like three different... Yeah, it's like watching, you know, must-see TV or some shit. Just three different three different rich stories. No Seinfeld or Ross, but, you know... You deal with it. You do get, whatchamacallit, Stryker from Ted from...
True, he's in there.
From Airplane, yeah.
Yeah. So let's get into the actual movie. We have our first segment is Quitter's Inc. I appreciate a straightforward credit sequence. The cat opens its eyes. In we go. Done and done.
Yeah.
Keep it simple, stupid.
We're in the cat's eye. We're in the cat's eye now, baby. Yeah.
I also have to respect this cat actor as it starts its journey. It comes so close to getting distracted by a bug flying around, but stays on track. It's like, God bless you, kid.
Yeah, it's definitely got a fucking better head on its shoulders than yours truly, so I'm way more easily distracted.
The prologue that explained why the cat was out here and ultimately traveling back to Wilmington, North Carolina, was cut by the studio, quote, in their infinite wisdom. Teague said it was way over the top, but fun. Basically, the cat is with another family in Wilmington, and one morning the daughter stops breathing, so while the dad calls the paramedics and tries to revive her, the mom, believing in the old wives' tale that comes back in the final segment, goes downstairs, grabs an automatic weapon, tries to take the cat out, who avoids the hail of bullets and escapes out the freshly shattered plate glass window.
Whoa, the mom uses a fucking machine gun on the cat?
That's right. I believe an Uzi was the specific gun.
Whoa, what's the setup that this Wilmington family has a fucking Uzi lying around ready to rip?
I don't know. Sound off, man. So call in.
That's so awesome. So the wives' tale is that a cat will steal your breath when you're sleeping.
That's right.
So maybe we would retroactively even assume that she was attacked by a troll, the North Carolina, right? Like, potentially?
Yeah, seems possible to me. He's running around in the area. That's how he goes after Drew. And Drew also did play both children, which also ties into why the general is like feels this affection and defensiveness towards her. So.
Right, right, right. I love that sequence. I mean, we'll jump around a little bit here, but I love that sequence when the troll, when we're in the troll POV running towards the house, and then you all of a sudden we just see the cat dart by. I'm like, this is so, the troll POV with the troll sound effects is a real fucking highlight of the movie on this.
It's really great.
On this rewatch, yeah.
I also, it was funny because, so I had the subtitles on just because that's my habitual use, but this was actually closed captions and not subtitles. So it kind of jumped the gun a little bit, and it was like, troll continues panting. I was like, what fucking troll, dude?
Spoiler!
The prologue, I think, does align with Stephen King's macabre humor. I think it would have worked. It would have lined up with the tone of the various segments. But the studio said that they didn't want to start with a dead child and shooting at a cat. So while it hurts the vision stuff a little bit, the opening in particular still works for me. Dogs chase cats. It's as simple as that. I've seen cartoons.
Right. I get it. I'm familiar with the age-old battle between cats and dogs. I'll be all right.
Right. Right. And indeed they do, as the cat meets Cujo and the chase is on. The Kingiverse is assembling quickly here as they pass a red Plymouth Fury with a Christine bumper sticker as well. Teague said he tried to include as many King references as possible to establish that silly tone. He also said this is the actual Cujo, one of the 9 St. Bernards used in that movie, who they brought back for this.
Yeah, and they fucking blooded him up, too, and made it pretty scary when you're like, whoa, 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 please don't get the cat. This cat I just learned about and just met. I do not want anything to happen to it.
Right. They also used 12 cats in this, not for the same reason as the dogs, where each dog would learn an individual trick that they would do on command. It's more that cats are not interested in doing a trick to please you. They do it for food. So they'd show the cats the trick. It would do it 2 or 3 times, then get full and stop giving a shit. So they'd have to like swap it out for another hungry cat.
Oh, that's awesome. I worked once for a pilot that never aired with a coyote. And the coyote trainer was like, a couple of things they said to us was, you're just going to walk past, it had like a wire around its neck. It's like, you just walk past it, you know, it won't hurt you, don't worry. They were like, firstly, a coyote is more like a rat than it is like a dog. So keep that in mind. You don't pet it. Like and I'm like, oh, that's interesting, because it's very dog like. And then the other thing they said was like, we only have 6 tries at this stunt because once it has its 6th treat, it will be no longer hungry and will not give a fuck what we ask it to do. I was just like, okay, and go ahead and stereotype what you think a Hollywood coyote trainer might be like, and you're getting there. You're in the right world. They are interesting people is like probably the nicest way to phrase any of this.
That's so funny, because Lewis Teague was talking about how this was the same animal handler as the movie Babe. Some Australian freak comes over with a gaggle of cats in his arms.
Oi, George Miller liked this cat. How do you feel about it now, lad?
That's cool. Can it play guitar and shoot flames out of it?
This cat is Lord Humongous. That's fucking awesome.
Yeah. So the cat hides in a trash can, but Cujo is still on the hunt when it emerges. It's so funny that he, like, tricked the cat. It's very personified. It feels like Tom and Jerry almost.
Right, right. Yeah. It's like the Jon Favreau reboot of Tom and Jerry. We're going to get real dogs and cats and not hire any animators or anything like that and remake money off the same script. Oh, okay.
Yeah,
cool.
What could go wrong?
Have fun.
Yeah. The cat tricks him back, though. He goes under a canoe and out the other side, scampering into the back of a truck headed for New York City.
Moo York City.
The cat sees a vision of Drew Barrymore in a mannequin, begging for help, but he's quickly kidnapped by a guy from Quitters, Inc. So we're suddenly thrust into the story proper. This is an anti-smoking clinic, which James Woods' Dick Morrison is nervously about to enter for treatment. The only other man in the lobby is weeping already and renews his gusto at seeing the cigarette in Dick's mouth. His wife emerges from the back of the house. She looks very haggard. She's barely upright. And he leaps up to greet her, but they stumble out of the clinic together. And he says to Dick, been a smoker since I was 16, so it was hard. And you're like, what the hell is going on here?
It's such a funny... And now we know Stephen King, avid smoker... All in all, just a classic addict. Mm-hmm. Applying that to this of like, you imagine the dark fantasy of like, what would get me to quit smoking? I guess threatening to cut my wife's pinky off or electrocuting Molly, my beagle that I love or whatever, you know, right. Like, or Corgi, right? He has a Corgi. Who cares? It feels real. And like, I'm in my early 40s now and I'm trying to get healthy and like, you know, dealing with some shit. And I'm like, it wouldn't be crazy to like hire like an acting troupe to like scare me into getting fit somehow. Like,
sure, chase you around. You have to be able to run.
I just have to keep running as these guys hunt me down one by one. That'd be fucking awesome.
I think you're spot on though, and there's a really good line in the story that I thought really connected to it, where he says, hugging his son tightly, realizing what Donati and his colleagues had so cynically realized before him, love is the most pernicious drug of all. Let the romantics debate its existence. Pragmatists accept it and use it.
Shit, yeah, right. Like, fuck with the one you love and it's over. You know what I mean? Right. Like, you got to do what you got to do. That shot, right, when they open up on... when there's so much rich shit in this. Like, when he gets caught... James Woods... plays a hell of a scumbag. Turns out...
Videodrome, incredible.
Yeah. Turns out he may actually be a bit of a scumbag, but that doesn't mean I can't enjoy his performance in this movie. When he cheats and smokes that cigarette in the car, the way he smiles like I'm winning, and then when the transition from when he sees the guy next to him like pull away, it's absolutely a masterclass in eye acting. Like, he doesn't say a thing, and you're like, oh, fuck. And he like starts racing home and shit like that.
It's so good. He is really perfect at like having a layer of humanity and a layer of sleaze. Like, he's like a believable sleazy guy.
Yes.
It was funny, in Videodrome, I think Pauline Kael called his performance authentic. Really fucking funny.
Hell yeah.
But yeah, so a man named Donati takes Dick back to his office to review the paperwork. He says, you have a daughter who's 10, but you left the area for school blank.
Terrifying.
Yeah, very scary. He's so quickly uncomfortable, very reasonably so.
Oh, I know. And it's Alan King in the role. And so he's like, he's charming and very easy to look at. And then he's like, as he's saying this shit, you're like, oh my God, this is fucking terrifying. Please.
Yeah, it really is. And this is actually one of the main changes from book to screen is in the book, it's a mentally handicapped son, and they change it to a gifted daughter. Presumably, the threat was a little too cruel in the book to put on screen.
Yeah, that might I might tend to agree there.
Yeah, I think that's a good change. Donati goes nuts, though, and smashes the cigarettes that Dick brought in, which is very funny, just pounding on the desk like that. Our methods are quite radical, he says. Dick isn't impressed, but he continues. It's not just availability, it's about conditioning. And so he demonstrates the torture chamber on our poor kidnapped cat. It blasts Shake It Up Baby while the floor becomes electrified. And it is a really, like we said, fucked up scene. You are immediately like, oh, these people are lunatics. Even as scummy as James Woods' character immediately seems, you are on his side because he's not this other people. He's not torturing a damn cat, but he's locked in the room with them. And just like he's locked in the room with his addiction.
Yeah, I like the way these guys kind of manhandle him a little bit, too. Like, Donati's, like, sidekick is, like, a little bit of a mafia enforcer type guy.
Right.
And he's a little more in, like, he's in the job for the wrong reason, and the Donati character feels like it's in the job because it's actively trying to get he's like, he cares about people quitting smoking, even though he goes above and beyond in this fucked up way. The other guy's kind of like, wait, we get to do fucked up shit? Like the guy who's in the military for the wrong reason or whatever. Yeah.
Right. And even Donati is like, oh, I love doing it for humanity, but it's also a nice tax angle.
Yeah, right.
And he does also imply that the severity of method comes from mafia member Mort Three Fingers Minnelli, who funded the organization while dying of lung cancer, and he explains the point of the demonstration. They're going to surveil him for a month, and he may see all the people some of the time, and he may see some of the people all of the time, but he won't see all of the people all of the time, and if he smokes, they'll know.
So awesome. And as we hear the police song throughout this entire movie, the every breath you take, I'll be watching you is so, I mean, it's weirdly on the nose for like all three sequences somehow, right? Like, you know, and it's, I think that's kind of cool to have found a song like that, that hits so hard. Like, they'll be watching you, the paranoia of the first story, take your breath, I mean, cigarettes and fucking trolls do that.
Yeah.
And then every step you take, I'll be watching you is definitely the ledge. Yeah.
Definitely. Damn. Holy shit. And so what, Dick scoffs. You'll throw me in the cat room? No, Mr. Morrison, Donati gently explains. We'll throw your wife in the cat room.
You
have to watch.
And that even rattles Woods, who's kind of like, what is this bullshit? He jumps back.
Yeah. And if you fail again, your daughter goes in. And a third time results in a deranged man assaulting your wife. And if you're one of the 2% who fails a fourth time, we give up. And he reveals his gun. And I love the line in the book, even the unregenerate 2% never smoke again. We guarantee it.
Meaning they're at least dead. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. Although you get 10 chances in the book.
Oh, okay. That's a little better. But so your wife gets assaulted on three is terrifying. Yeah. And we see what happens based on the mafia guy. That's a fun little closer to this segment when we see the woman toast with her pinky missing.
That's right. That's right. That night, Dick watches The Dead Zone at home and spills his drink all over himself. He blames the TV and grouses, who writes this crap? Nice, easy laugh.
Yep. Making fun of fucking
King himself.
Stephen King himself, yeah.
His wife wonders why he's in such a bad mood, and he admits that he quit, which his wife is thrilled but skeptical of. Not just that he did it, but that I'll be able to maintain it. He says, I think I'll make it. And obviously, it's much more intense than she knows. But at 3:17 a.m., Dick wakes to thunder and lightning, and brother, he's feeling the storm inside, too, because he wants a smoke bad. He creeps downstairs. He scares the crap out of himself in the mirror, which is funny. And then he goes into his office. I love the heartbeat really high in the mix as he scours his desk. Makes you feel that tension. And he finds a lone cigarette left in a crumpled pack. But when he lights the match, he hears some creaking outside.
Oh, terrifying. The fucking closet shit, too. Like,
oh, man. He extinguishes the match before lighting the cigarette itself, and he goes looking for the intruder in his closet. And what he finds instead is a golf bag that falls out, which, to be fair, he does beat up.
Right, yeah, he does. He does seem terrified and goes hand to hand against the golf clubs.
That's right. He also apologizes to a pair of boots he sees there, saying, "I didn't smoke it, see, so you can tell Donati." And we laugh and we think, oh, he's just paranoid, obviously. But suddenly they show us the pool of water forming at the boots. And I was really like, oh, fuck, that's good as hell.
Terrifying. That's yeah. So fun.
The next morning, he spots this big guy running in dress shoes, which you take to be more surveillance, and he checks the closet again, thinking about this, to see that the boots are gone and there are footprints. Great stuff. I also like that the next scene, they go to St. Stephen's School for the Exceptional, which is obviously a reference to King himself. I like to think that that was like his trade. He was like, you can only make fun of me for the Dead Zone if you get to also make me St. Stephen the Exceptional.
Right, please. If you make me Charles Xavier as well, I would be happy. Right. Yeah.
Dick drops off a Cabbage Patch doll for his daughter to affirm for both of them that he loves her, but there's Donati looming and promising constant supervision because it's necessary to beat the habit. And then, yeah, Every Breath You Take plays, and we join a party with Dick that's absolutely covered in smoke. Everyone and their damn mother.
This is so fucking fun. I'm old enough, and I was bartending in the early 2000s, that I remember when New York went from you allowed to smoke in bars to not smoke in bars. And the change was like, oh my God, this is going to save people's lives. Like, it's going to save me a fortune in fucking laundry, and it's going to save people's lives. But that had me flash back to like 2002 when everyone's just blasting darts in the fucking inside the bars, and James Reborn is like the friend and he's like so annoying and everyone's just smoking, and he looks over at one point and his wife is like talking to a guy who's blowing like a nearly constant stream of smoke straight up in the air, like he just took some huge hit of cig. It's fucking awesome.
My favorite one is the two actual children who are ashing their cigs over the punch. Like, what the fuck?
Oh, right.
Ruin it for everyone else. But it does get more and more exaggerated. People are smoking out of their ears. There's a cigarette between each finger, using both hands to smoke. And he's tempted, but he seems to see a smoking poster that's watching him and a tray of deviled eggs that are watching him. And Donati himself coming down the stairs singing in a beautiful rhinestone jumpsuit.
Crazy.
Constant supervision. Very funny story about the song, now that we're talking about it. Obviously, the song is a fortune to license, and Dino didn't want to do it. So Lewis did two takes of this, one where he comes down just dancing, and one where he was mouthing the words. And he only showed Dino the one where he's mouthing. And Dino goes, "Lewis, what are you doing? You're forcing me to buy the rights now." But here's the thing, John. If you listen close, you'll notice it is, in fact, not the Police.
Nope.
He got the rights to a cover of it.
Smart.
The old skinflint Dino strikes again.
Yeah, yeah. I wasn't expecting him to spend a lot of money.
I think that probably would have covered their entire $9 million budget to license the actual Police song at that time. But then he's stuck in traffic the next day. He reaches into his glove box for a tape. He notices a pack of cigarettes. Everyone around him seems to be completely occupied between a pillow fight and making out. So he puts on his best discreet sunglasses, ducks down and starts puffing away. And yeah, grinning to himself that he got away with it. It's so funny. The only problem is, as the traffic clears and he sits back up to drive, he looks out the window and sees the guy who was making out is not driving either. He grins and tips his hat to Dick as he sees him with the cigarette dangling out of his damn mouth.
Yeah, he's like, "I didn't," and he starts chasing him as he drives away. Hell yeah.
That's right. According to Lewis, this guy was one of Sly Stallone's bodyguards.
Oh, shit. Cool.
Makes a lot of sense when you hear the line, "He tried to get smart with his fists, but unfortunately he's got very dumb fists." Even before listening to the commentary, I was like, that's a Rocky line.
Yeah, for sure.
He speeds home, though. He finds the screen door torn, something burning in the pan, because old Cindy got yanked out of here quick.
Oh, man. Haunting.
It really is. The phone rings. Donati's just like, CF5, bitch. It's scary, scary stuff.
Yeah. We got your wife hooked up to the charger. You're going to want to come see this.
That's right. And Five rolls around, and Dick is carried into Donati's office by the very man who snitched on him. Hate to see that. The cat escapes in the hubbub of Dick trying to fight off the goon and break open the glass to his wife, but it's too thick, he's quickly subdued, and it is rough stuff as she leaps around in pain and fright, She's finally released, but I think it is, like, effectively upsetting. She does a really good job acting there.
Yeah, no, the hair is really funny, but it is, she is making me scared. She does, she does sell me.
Definitely. And watching Dick explain the situation to her, Donati wins $10 off the goon because he predicts that Cindy will understand and hug Dick, and she does.
Yeah, it's a cool moment. He's like, when you've done this as long as I have, we don't even need the volume. There's one of two options here. She either slaps him or takes him back, and she stands by her man.
So true, so true. The cat takes the Staten Island Ferry to get the fuck out of there. I love the public transit this cat takes. He's on a train later, too.
I know. He gets around. I wish we had that kind of light rail system that the cat has.
And we rejoin Dick 6 months later. He's in Venati's office again, but they're all pals now, and he's getting weighed. They don't want him to gain a bunch of weight now that he's done smoking, so here, take these highly illegal diet pills, and we're setting your max weight at 165 pounds. Or what, asks Dick. You'll send someone to my house with a flamethrower? No, we'll send someone to cut off your wife's little finger. Ha ha ha, you rascal, you kill me, Venati's Dick says as they leave with a handshake.
Oh. And then he's at dinner fucking... I love that they toast to Quitter's Inc. Like, it's changed our lives so positively. And the one woman is just, like, haggard, and she's like, uh-huh.
Yeah, she's a little more hesitant than the rest of them as she lifts her champagne. She's got this recently stitched up stump of a little finger. Wasn't a joke after all. What the heck?
Boom. We out. I love
that. That's right. One change that I wanted to mention... from the book to the screen, that I get the cut because it doesn't really work outside of the text, but I do think it's funny, so I wanted to mention it. They send him the bill for his treatment, which is $2,500 for treatment, $2,500 for his counselor, and 50 cents for the electricity used to zap his wife.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, you're going to pay for it as well.
So now we're entering segment two. The cat gets a bit of hot dog from a homeless gentleman under the pier, then scampers off because he's at the Atlantic City Boardwalk, baby. Kitty needs a new pair of shoes.
As again, I love this fucking, I just love, it keeps it in the tri-state area. Like, it's like, it could be Vegas. Nope, we're in Atlantic City. It's going to be, it's going to be a touch trashier.
Oh, man, I love, like, that kind of time capsule where you get to, like, just have the footage of like, the pier and everything. I'm like, oh, fuck yeah, this rocks. He gets distracted by an electronic shop display full of TVs showing a cat food commercial featuring Drew Barrymore, when suddenly he has another vision of Drew Barrymore not in the commercial, but talking to him, like with the mannequin, and she says, it's still looking for me. You're my only hope, Cat Kenobi. And Mr. Kressner, a high roller, leaves a casino. This is Ken McMillan. He's so good. He's so funny in this role. He's really hamming it up, chewing the damn scenery.
Oh, he's a blast. He's a true blast. And I like we set them up down here, and then we get to just see him be an absolute kind of psycho in a fun way. Like, it's a good time all around.
Definitely.
Kressner, great name.
Right. First thing we learn about him, besides his name and that he's rich, is that his wife is cheating on him, which you definitely don't want that to be in your main attributes.
Right, yeah. Here's your character description. Now, as someone who's just watched both Dunes and is listening to the audiobook, remembering that he is Lynch's Harkonnen is very exciting. This guy has got some great credits.
That's right.
Oh, he's also in the... in maybe what is considered the best canon film, not maybe the most fun, but the best made one, Runaway Train with Eric Roberts and John Voight. He's also that. Yeah.
Is he the warden? No.
No, I'm not sure who he is. I just remember him from that.
Yeah, well, hey, great fucking movie, and he's right to be in it.
Yeah.
That got an Oscar nomination, didn't it? That's crazy.
I believe it did.
Good for you, Cannon.
Hell yeah.
He confirms with his chauffeur that night that Ducky is right on the cheating couple's tail. Then he and his pals, about to head to the Golden Nugget to see old Dino Martin, stop to watch the cat attempting to dart across the street. And the one lady is like, look at that cat. And you think she's going to be like, oh, I hope it survives this harrowing trip across a busy Atlantic City strip. And instead she's like, my daddy said all cats should be drowned once they stop playing with spools. Christ. They decide to bet on it, though. $2,000 on if the cat makes it. She scoffs in disbelief. You guys will bet on anything. And Kressner scoffs right back. Yeah, that's what it's all about. They also say you can do anything you want to impact the bet, which will, of course, come back later. But the cat does make it. It causes a huge crash in the process to Kressner's delight. This is a fun split screenshot. It's matted together so that the cat wasn't literally next to a multi-car pileup.
Yeah, it looked good. It looked pretty. It looked pretty good. It did, again, gave you that sense of danger that you don't want around animals, but don't care if it's a stuntman for some reason.
Right. And so Kressner tells them to go see Dean. I'm going to take this guy home for a bowl of milk because he earned it. And he also says, get Ducky on the radio. Tell him to nail this bastard. I appreciate when they just like don't shy away from just being on the nose like that. It's yeah. Like, yeah, just go for it.
I'm the villain, remember? You're like, okay, yeah, got it.
Turns out his wife isn't just cheating on Kressner. She's also running away with this tennis instructor, Johnny Norris, changed from Stan Norris, which I feel like kind of a weird change, but whatever.
Yeah, to make it Johnny for some reason, yeah. Who cares? Yeah.
She warns him that Kressner is dangerous, but he says he needs to wait for the bank to open because they're freaking broke. So he sends her ahead to New York on a bus, and he's meeting her at the hotel after a smooch. Ducky and his pal kidnap Johnny, and Charles Dutton is one of these goons here, and he told Louis Teague on the night they were shooting that he didn't know how to drive. So they had to teach him enough to at least cover the shot of him pulling in to park at Kressner's. And if you look at it, he comes in too hot still and hits the curb, but it was take 7 and they said, fuck it.
Oh, that's so awesome. Yeah, and the guy who plays Ducky is the gas man from Dumb and Dumber, that guy, right?
Yes.
How do they know? How do you think they know that about me? So fucking
Mike Starr,
yes,
so fucking funny.
Yes, that's his name. Yeah. Also, the clown from Uncle Buck. He's one of the villains, one of the goons in Miller's Crossing. Dude's got a fucking hell of a resume. Oh, he's so fun. He's so fucking fun. And that's perfect casting for two thugs, two guys who are actually scary.
Yeah. So they get to Kressner. There's a great shot of the chauffeur leaning over the recently punched Johnny with the building towering over his shoulder. Not only cool because it's just a good-looking miniature that they mounted behind him, but also gives you like a cool emotional foreshadowing because the threat of the height specifically is on display already.
Right, and it's a cool shot just showing scale at first, and then you don't realize how much this will pay off shortly.
Right.
Ooh, yeah.
Kressner reveals the plan. They've set him up. They planted a bag of heroin in his car. Marshall will come back with nowhere else to go, and with an existing drug record, by the time Mr. Norris is out of prison, he'll be more concerned with his arthritis than his libido. Got his ass.
Take that, bro.
Unless that is, he wants to take the wager that Kressner is offering. A very simple wager. All Mr. Norris has to do is clamber onto a 5-inch ledge that circles the roof and go all the way around the building. You get the money and you get my wife if you do. But if you lose your balance even once, he trails off and lets the implication do a lot of work there.
Yeah.
As we get all kinds of looks at the city below and the buildings around them, it's kind of wild that these are all miniatures. Some of them are literally hanging from the camera. The only real thing was the balcony itself. Truly kind of, that's fucking movie magic, baby.
They really succeed in this. You can see the background looking different. You know, you see it, but the fact that it's not fully digital for some reason really get, you know, it's, it had my like teeth chattering a little. I was like, yikes. The pigeon shit was not the pigeon poop, but the pigeon pecking at their ankles really fucking stressed me out.
Oh, yeah. Big time. They talked in the commentary about how little money they had, plus digital effects didn't exist. So it was partially out of necessity. But part of what also makes it very effective is the lighting. It's being hit by the same light as the actors. So there's never any weird discrepancies like you can get with CGI that looks flat from being lit wrong. Or even sometimes matte paintings can have weird contrasting lighting.
Right.
So it was actually about 10 to 15 feet up because they had to be shooting up sometimes. They did need some height. Yeah, it's very effective. Scary stuff.
Fuck yeah, it worked on me. I don't even have like a heights fear. I have claustrophobia. Spoiler alert for F3. But it got me. I was like, oh, yeah. But I am also a gambler. So I was like, I get this too. You know?
That's right. Oh, it's a wager, not even just a bet. Oh, yeah. I'm in. Norris decides to go for it. He says, you Welsh on your bets? And Kressner is hurt. I've never Welshed on a bet in my life. And then when Norris looks away, he makes a goofy face at Ducky, which really got a big laugh from me. I was like, I don't even know what that is doing in this movie.
Yeah, they seem to be like fucking around a little bit. Yeah.
Sebastian the cat seems to like Norris. Maybe that's a good sign, he says, huh? And down he goes. Kressner taunts him and grabs his hand, even smacking him with the robe. But Norris retains his balance and he turns the corner. But when he tries to sneak in a window on the other side, Ducky is there and Kressner honks a classic horn in Norris's ear like a damn clown out here. But the combo is enough to send Johnny plummeting. But he manages to land atop another border, and he watches in terror as the horn drops and crumples against the sidewalk, and Kressner is up there cackling, just keeping you on your toes, Mr. Norris.
Great joke there. Great line.
Yeah.
So intense for how small and weird this is, right? Like, I guess this is what I was thinking of earlier when I was like, and they're such small stories. And like, this is just like, we've seen Tom Cruise climb the Burj Khalifa and his magnetic glove goes off or whatever. But this feels so much scarier for some reason. Like, and we knew Tom was actually on the Burj Khalifa. And for some reason, this is just so much scarier. Well, like, you know what he's, you know why he's doing it, all this shit. And we don't even know what this guy does about welching on his bets or whatever. We haven't even found out yet.
Yeah, it is super effective. Sebastian the cat doesn't like it, though. Kressner scolds him as he hisses. Where's your sense of humor, he says. Well. And this is where we get to the pigeon part. Pecks the hell out of Johnny's ankle as he continues his journey. It's very fucked up. I've always said you can't trust birds. Here's more proof. I got randomly pecked by a seagull at a beach in Long Island. Birds be pecking. That's what they do.
You gotta watch out. Birds are freaks, man. They're out to get humans. That I know for sure.
Yeah. Really funny description of it in the book. Quote, "There was a pigeon standing on the ledge, looking up with bright, hateful eyes. You get used to pigeons in the city. They're as common as cab drivers who can't change a 10. They don't like to fly, and they give ground grudgingly, as if the sidewalks were theirs by squatters' rights. Oh, yes. And you're apt to find their calling cards on the hoods of your car. But you never take much notice. They may be occasionally irritating, but they're interlopers in our world. But I was in his, and I was nearly helpless, and he seemed to know it."
Awesome.
And so he starts to bleed from this little fucker, and after finally making it to a little alcove, correctly does a big punt of it. Hilarious explosion of feathers. There's a big squawk. It's great.
It's so cool. It turns something that's so ubiquitous into something that's just so scary.
Yeah. And Kressner wants him to keep moving, so he opens a hose on Norris. Painful, no doubt, but also, I think, fucked up to impact the environment like that. Now it's all wet and slippery.
Yeah, this is where Kressner doesn't understand like how a fair wager is supposed to go. But I got a feeling we're going to see a few more steps he takes to see how unfair this dude is.
I guess. But he does warn Mr. Norris, that was open a half valve. So get going or I'll blast you right out this hole. And as he crosses the glowing WT sign across the building, it does start to fall. This is scary stuff. Sebastian the cat just watching like an asshole. God damn it. But sparks fly as Johnny manages to climb a wire to the ledge. And as Kressner sees that he's going to make it, he runs inside to plot with his goons. And this is maybe my favorite part in the entire movie, where he's like trying to get the cue line specific, and the goon is like, "I get it," but he doesn't say it correctly both times.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Kressner's just like, "Fuck, I guess it'll be fine. Like, it's not my vision." You also get to see the issue of Penthouse that the ledge first appeared in. Fun little Easter egg. But he says, "Well, I told you I don't welch on my bets, Mr. Norris. I'm just an extremely bad loser. So your car is clean, you have the money, and you have my wife." And he kicks open the bag and her damn head falls out.
When I say, all right, Mr. Norris, that's when you come out. So, all right, Mrs. Norris. No, it's all right, like, I love all that bullshit. And then you don't know it's culminating in a fucking head roll. Like, that's awesome.
Yeah. Oh, it's really, really fun. Jesus, Johnny screams and he attacks. The goon tries to shoot him, but trips on the fleeing Sebastian, and Johnny grabs the gun to shoot him in the back. And now Kressner is on the defensive. That money was chicken feed, he promises. How's $2 million sound? Well, I'll make you a bet. Not a wager, because I'm not some fancy hood like you. Just a simple bet. And out Kressner goes to repeat the walk around the roof.
Ah, it's so good. It doesn't seem like this would be the end of the story. And it's just so fun that he's like, now get your ass out there. Like, me making it wasn't the resolution. You falling will be the resolution, which is so cool.
Yeah, I love it. I love the pigeon is what ultimately sends him down as he kicks out at it and tumbles right onto the horn with a nice honk. It is also a little more of a catharsis, satisfying ending. The book ends with Johnny listening from the apartment, and he says, "Was that the wind or a scream?" And then he says, "Kressner said he's never welched on a bet. but I've been known to.
Oh, hell fucking yeah. So cool. It's a cool fucking line, man.
Yeah, for sure. So we enter the third segment, The General, it's called, and we're back in Wilmington, North Carolina. The cat said, the hobo's life for me, jumped on the rails. Here he is.
I'm not afraid of no Uzi. Let me get back to where I once belonged.
That's right. This is where we get the troll POV. Very fun shots. It's just scrambling around. And we see Drew Barrymore is a girl named Amanda washing the car with her dad. And when mom goes to call them for lunch, the cat follows the troll into the house. In the cut prologue, we would have also seen that it wasn't a cat stealing the breath at all, but it was this troll. He's looking for a new victim here. But yeah, like we said, she reminds him of the victim because they were the same. So he's there to regain his cat honor and defend her. Amanda's stoked. She wants to keep Sebastian. And she says, what if the vet checks him out and says he's fine and nobody comes for him? And I say, pretty please with sugar on top. But she also changes Sebastian's name to General. I'm curious, how do you feel about that shift? Upgrade? Downgrade?
I think it's maybe an upgrade, and I don't know why she decided the name was the General. Like, I have no idea. But I really, like, I like that from a little kid. My cousin, when he was young, they got a dog, and he got to name it anything he wanted, and he named it Bridge.
Wow.
And it was like, a dog named Bridge is weird. But the General, I like, I don't know why I like that so much. It sounds like an old, like, Goomba who, like, sits at the Knights of Columbus and drinks fucking limoncello all the time or something. That's some right. Yeah.
Named after my favorite game, to play with the boys. That's funny. I also like kind of like weird names like that, even if it's just like a weird juxtaposition. My brother, when my mom married my dad, she converted to Judaism so that they could get married in a temple. And my brother got to pick his own Hebrew name. And he was obsessed with Ninja Turtles at the time, as everyone was. And he said, I'm going to pick the perfect Jewish name, Raphael.
Oh, hell yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah,
that's
fine.
I'm now Jewish, and my name is Raphael, and I'm rude.
But cool.
Yeah, oh, don't forget.
She asks General to guard her, although Mom kicks his ass outside since their arrangement doesn't include bedroom privileges. Fucking harsh, Mom. But the next morning, she's pissed because it would appear General was in the room after all. There's cat hair all over, knocked over toys. What the hell? And so she threatens to send General to the shelter if it happens again, if only for Polly the Bird's sake. And Dad joins in. Besides, we talked to Nana last night, and she said cats steal kids' breath. You have to put all the animals outside, especially the cat animals, because if you don't, they climb up on your chest and suck all your breath out like this. Shroop.
Oh, terrifying. Terrifying. What he's describing is exactly what the troll would later do. And the right. Troll doing that was so triggering to me growing up. It fucked me up so much that I think I got claustrophobia from this movie. Like, it really broke me. Like, I would, if I like rolled over and was like sleeping kind of face down on my pillow and like had my breath like at all restricted, I would like snap awake with like a racing heart. Cause like this movie had fucked me up. I just saw it like too young, I think. And now watching it, it's like comically unscary. And I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe this affected me so much. The troll is like cute and funny and makes funny noises and all this, but it wasn't even about the troll itself. It was about the idea that while you were sleeping, you could stop breathing. And that, I mean, obviously that's dying in your sleep is a fear, you know what I mean? Like, right. And they play with that hard, but holy shit, twisted me up.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. You say that it's comically unscary, but there is one moment where he like, when he squeezes her nose shut,
yep, that's the one.
Yeah, like that's unsettling. That's unpleasant.
Unsettling, and then he starts breathing in. Like that shit is fucked up.
Mm-hmm. So the mom says, very helpful, Hugh. Jokes about mom's accent. At this hour? Come on. Mom also spots General eating a bird. Nonviolent my ass, she grouses. But I don't know what she wants this guy to eat, right? She threw him outside.
Yeah, you know, dude, put the fucking kitty food out there or else a cat's got to eat, mamacita.
That's damn right. And that evening, Amanda tells her dad that she's been having bad dreams about a troll like from the story about the goats, and it lives in her wall, right there. And the specificity of the location and the way it cuts to the wall looking both very normal, but things like slightly askew because it's this huge set, it does give me a little thrill to be like, oh.
Yeah, it's disorienting in an interesting way. You're like, oh, whoa, what the fuck am I? What I'm looking at is weird and I don't know why, you know?
Right.
And we will find out.
Right. But she says, General kept the dream away last night. And Dad says he's going to try and convince Mom. But in the meantime, there's no real monsters, so go to sleep. And in bed that night, Mom is reading Pet Sematary as Dad starts in. You know, she was starting to cry as I kissed her goodnight, he says. Mom groans, I just don't trust that cat. Mom has got some issues, I feel like.
Yeah.
Don't trust the cat.
Well, Mom's got to deal with Dad's corny-ass jokes all the time, so I totally fucking get it. Like, she's like, I've had enough. He's like, I didn't know the bird's pecker was that big. And you're like, oh, God, shut the fuck up. Don't talk like that in front of our daughter.
The troll does emerge from the wall. He is a cute little guy. He's got his little jingle bell hat on. This was state of the art. Unfortunately, and less cutely, he climbs up on the birdcage and murders the hell out of Polly while poor General watches helplessly from outside.
Oh, so fucked up. There's like, we talked about this on Action Boys recently. There's this element of movies, especially in the 80s and 90s. I think it happens now too, but I like thinking of these movies where you're like, your character that you're supposed to be supporting is being like, gaslit or not believed by their parents, by the authorities, because of some nefarious actor. That shit used to get me. Like when I was a kid, I remember distinctly being like, no, why would the cat do it? You gotta trust. Like it's so clearly something else, man. Like, and then when you're a grown up, you're like, I'm sure it's a troll. Like, right. Get the fuck out of here.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that because Teague, to jump ahead just a little bit, talks about feeling like the troll segment is the least successful because while the first two deal with those identifiable fears like consequences of addiction or heights, not many people stay up at night worrying about trolls. But where I disagree with him is that it captures the very real fear of not being believed, especially as a kid. Oh. And I think that that is a relatable thing.
Right. I didn't even think of that. Yeah, it's terrifying. Like, no, I swear to God, you know? and of course, like, I don't deserve that from my parents because I would lie about report cards and use the same exact energy and tone. So
right.
I really don't have too much of a place to say anything.
Hey, man, the boy who cried wolf had feelings, too.
Thank you.
Done with Polly, the troll climbs up on Amanda to steal her breath. Nana had it all wrong. It's trolls, not cats. Come on, Nana.
Nana, get your fucking head out of your ass, you know?
Come on.
You stop black people from voting, and now you also want to...
She's like marking no on should cats be allowed indoors? Should black people get the vote?
Yeah, she's just a bad actor all around. We got to get rid of Nana.
That's right. I think Dad had the right idea making fun of her at any hour.
Right.
But General ascends a tree to try and defend Amanda, and the troll legit pulls a knife on him, which I was like, whoa.
Now, the knife is so cute. It's like a little like wavy blade, like a Chris knife. I know that means something else now because of Dune, but I think that's what it was called back in the day.
Yeah.
And later on, when the fucking dad picks it up at the end of the movie, it really loses its teeth. It seems really unscary in a fun way.
It's so funny when he picks it up. I love that. But he flees from General. All I could think about how fun it must have been to have those oversized sets to run around on while he's doing this. I'm like, God bless. But he throws the knife at General, who yowls and darts out the window, knocking over the birdcage en route while the troll cackles, then seals up the wall. And Mom blames General, thanks to the paw prints on the windowsill. And yes, Dad sees the knife wound on the cat, and she dismisses it as good for Polly getting one good shot in. And this is, yes, when the Polly having such a big pecker.
It doesn't work, okay?
Yeah. And when Dad leaves for work, Mom gets to work trapping the cat like a psychopath, bringing him to the animal shelter in revenge, giving us a good long look at their menacing smokestack.
Scary.
Yeah. Amanda looks for General that night as a storm rolls in. She's pissed at her mom and sure he ran away because of her. Meanwhile, we see him being scheduled for termination the following day. Poor fella. And the troll emerges again that night. No General to defend you this time as he clocks the closed window. He also sticks a door jamb in the underneath the door to make sure they're not interrupted.
Kind of weird.
Ba- back at the shelter, General is playing it so casual. This cracked me up. He's like, who, me? I'm just lying on my side here. Cool as a fucking cucumber, my guy.
Yeah, I'm just sleeping, snoozing it up. Everyone play right. Colt, yeah.
Yeah, and the shelter worker goes to feed him, and out he goes like a damn shot. The triumphant music is really the icing on the cake. It's a funny moment from Silvestri. It's like truly feels like Back to the Future all of a sudden.
Yeah, you're like, he's really doing it. General's really doing it. He's running.
The troll climbs the bed. It's funny when he accidentally tickles her foot and she kicks him into a drum.
That's fun. Yeah. The creepy fucking door stopper shit. It's like all this stuff is so scary. Like it's terrifying.
For sure. And he climbs back up just as General makes his way to the window. And the troll inhales deeply, stealing Amanda's breath as she coughs weakly. So General says fuck it and goes Santa mode down the damn chimney.
The breath effect looked cool. Like I thought it's haunting. It's silly and haunting at the same time. It's a good combo.
Definitely. And the troll is pissed. He whips out his knife as General attacks, and they clash atop Amanda, who wakes up and screams after a brief choking fit from the stolen breath. I really like that touch that she like can't talk right away.
Coming back from it is cool.
The parents can't get in though because of the jam, but things are looking okay for General as the troll's hole is blocked by a book. Very funny when he like javelins a crayon at him.
I like their little combat. We see them like all the way up into like the record player. They're doing pretty much stunty gag type fights here, and it's working on me.
Absolutely. And yeah, he spots a bunch of balloons. He figures he'll float to safety, but he's a chubby little guy and he's still within range of General's jumps. So he leaps to the record player, which General turns on and Every Breath You Take plays again. As we say, it works again because General is watching over her. But also, I'm sure they were like, we're going to ring every damn cent out of this song. You tricked me into licensing.
Yeah, well, Every Breath You Take, that's the troll. And then I really like this moment where she's like, faster. And General's like, you got it, sister. Yes. He's DJing at this point. He's waiting for the drop like Steve Aoki. He's like, here we go. Boom, every breath you take, every move you make.
The record does go faster and faster. It eventually launches the troll, who slams into a box fan right into the blades, explodes into pink mist. Ah, fantastic.
So cool. So much fucking brutal shit. Later on when the dad's like looking at the knife, he's like, what is this? And it's like, wait, don't you see the viscera caught in the fucking fan? There's like a little troll arm and like guts hanging out of it and shit like that. And the other thing I want to call out is the fan has the streamers on it, like it would be in a store to let you know it's working. Mm-hmm. And you don't need that at home when you're running your fan, but the audience might need it to understand that this weird box over here is a fan.
Right. That's funny. I didn't even think about that. She finally lets her parents in. Yeah, they freak out at General. The indications of the troll are still there, so they finally have to believe her. And they tell her not to tell anyone about this. And while the mom calls it blackmail, I'd call it more Amanda successfully negotiating. She leverages this into keeping General, and he can sleep at night with her.
Ah, it's so awesome. And like the victory, yes, we defeated the troll that was stealing breath that probably killed this other kid from the preamble that we never that we never saw. But the like real victory is now my kitty gets to sleep with me. And I'm like, this is a Stephen King movie that horrified me to the bones when I was a kid. and the big resolution at the end is like, my kitty can sleep with me. I'm like, oh, okay, fuck. I feel a little soft. Yeah.
It is funny. General, he gets to finish off a big fish. He climbs up the stairs to their room. But there is a really fun moment here where he like jumps on the bed and climbs onto her chest and he leans in close. And I was like, oh my God, he was going to steal her breath all along.
So what a dark ending. Zoom in on the cat's eye again. Yeah, hell yeah.
But he actually licks her. She wakes up, hugs him contentedly, and credits roll, baby. Ray Stevenson singing Cat's Eye.
Fuck yeah, dude. Oh man, what a fucking picture.
Yeah, it's fucking great shit. And now, John, we've reached the part of the episode where we sum up why it's not just a good horror movie, but is in fact the best horror movie ever made. And I'm going to let you start.
I think Cat's Eye is the best horror movie ever made because it is horror movies. It's three in one. You get three different tastes. It's Neapolitan ice cream. It's working for you. That and we have miniatures. We have fake giant buildings. What more does one need? If you're not scared, if you're scared of your addiction, are you scared of your gambling addiction, or are you scared of your addiction to sleeping oxygen? You, no matter what addiction you have, this movie will activate it. And that's why I believe Cat's Eye, directed by Louis Teague, who I am now remembering also directed one of my favorite action films of the 90s, Navy SEALs, with Charlie Sheen and Michael Biehn. Love that fucking movie so much. Didn't realize he directed that. This, you know, Cat's Eye, come on. King of horror and fucking Drew Barrymore working together. Let's let it rip, dude.
Hell yeah. And, you know, now that you say it, I'm realizing I'm addicted to oxygen when I sleep.
Oh, dude, it's bad news. It gets the best of us, man.
To me, this is the best horror movie ever made because Stephen King is one of our most prolific, most accomplished horror writers. And I think that this does such a great job of capturing exactly what is so special about his writing. It is funny. It is corny in the right ways. It has legitimate thrills and chills. It's fucking good stuff, man. It is King through and through. And as you say, we get three different stories, which I love about it. I think that it is sort of a sampling of his own style. It does touch on the relatable themes like we've been talking about the whole time, but also does have that fantastical ending with the troll one, which I love. It has good effects. They're working with the budget, but the like everything that indicates its budget is like things that I like. Like I like when you can see that it's a little like maybe threadbare on the fringe. But
yeah, I like when it's a practical effect. I like when you fucking build a giant room for a little person to run around in. You know, like that shit rules.
That's right. And it's got so many great actors really getting a chance to live it up, man. They are having a good time making this movie. And I think that it comes across, and I have a good damn time watching it.
Yeah. Oh, something you think about in the production. Like, it's easy to get good actors for an anthology movie because it's like, you'll be a lead, but you only have to work 2 weeks. You know what I mean? Like, it's not, you're not, we're not locking you in forever. So you can get James Woods, you can get Stryker from Airplane, all the top tiers.
That's right. All the big dogs are coming out to play. And I don't just mean Cujo.
Who is in this film.
That's right. And that's what makes this the best horror movie ever made. John, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show, man. This was an absolute blast. We're reaching plugs time. Anything you want to direct the people towards, tell them now, please.
Yeah,
do.
Sure. Depending on when this episode comes out, I'm doing a 420 live stream, the third annual High and Mighty Mega Sesh, which is live. If you live in Los Angeles, you can buy live tickets, come down to the Dynasty Typewriter, bring your vape, play along. Or if you want to watch from home or prefer to smoke flower indoors at your own place, the live stream is also available and it'll be up for like a week or so after the event. So that's all those tickets are for sale at 420.gabris.com.
I know I'll be there in the audience.
Hell listening, yeah. So. Thanks, dude.
Definitely encourage people to check that out. This will be out with plenty of time for people to get tickets because it's coming out on Monday. So definitely go and check it out. It's going to be a lot of fun. It has been the last 2 years. So
thanks, bro.
And also check out Action Boys.
Oh, hell yeah. Check out my rocks. If you like movie podcasts, we have a movie podcast called Action Boys. You can get free episodes at free.actionboys.biz. Maybe get a sniff, get hooked.
Hell yeah.
I'm telling the rumor here first. We're dropping another free episode for you sickos who don't have the $5 a month, which I totally understand, by the way. But we will be dropping some free stuff, try to get you hooked, try to get you to join up.
Keep an eye out for that, folks. As far as my plugs, the show is coming to a close, so not really plugging too much stuff coming up, except that we're not going out with a whimper here. We got a lot of great guests still upcoming. Besides John, Nick Weiger is coming up pretty soon, so that'll be really fun. He's talking about Ninja Scroll.
Oh, well, which I watched under the name Wind Ninja Chronicles.
Wow, there you go.
I love that movie. I can't wait to text Weiger about that right now.
Hell yeah. I'm looking forward to that. There's also been a lot of great guests in the back catalog. People probably know Hayes Davenport. We talked about Under the Silver Lake. Mike Mitchell talked about Child's Play. Betsy Sodaro talking about Prom Night 2.
Hell yeah.
Lots of great stuff. So check out the back catalog. You'll definitely see names you recognize, movies you recognize. Check it out. And hey, as the show comes to a close, I would love to hit 100 ratings on iTunes. So, kind of just a nice little capper. So leave a review for the show if you haven't done that already. That's it. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Bye.